Friday weekly Block Talk Radio show with your show host Andrew Herod. And today we want to talk about happiness. It's actually something that people over the ages have actually thought really seriously about, because we want to talk here with Franciscan University Professor of Criminal Justice Charles Namath, who has published a new book with Sophia Institute Press, Finding Happiness in a Complex World: Rules from Aristotle and Aquinas. And he looks at what these two thinkers from the ancient Greek world, the classical world, and from the 13th century have thought about happiness. Well, Professor Namath, thank you for joining the show.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew, and I'm really pumped up. I loved your introductory song.
Well, I guess we're in a happy mood. Well,
that's right. It's Friday. It's Friday, too.
Thank God it's Friday. Conservative casual Friday here. We can relax and talk about important issues for conservatives and others. And, well, just starting out, tell our listeners, talk about your biography a little bit. I mean, how does a criminal justice professor get involved with Aristotle, Aquinas, and happiness?
That's interesting. I've been a lawyer in three jurisdictions for nearly almost 40 years. So I have a lot of practical experience on the criminal justice side of things. And I practice in New York and Pennsylvania and North Carolina over these years. And, you know, of course, I encounter a lot of the reality of what goes on in the system. And I've also simultaneously been an academic who was interested in the field of criminal justice, and I went and pursued, started criminal justice programs in about five different institutions over my lifetime, but I always had this empty feeling, this feeling that there's something missing in this equation. Even though I'm very pro police and very pro, prosecutor, I'm very much in favor of the collective defending itself against those that wreak havoc on the collective. But I always felt that my life's ambition, this is particularly came true when I was at John Jay in New York City, which is where I retired from about 2 years ago. I said, I have to create something that blends the two worlds of criminal justice professionalism, best practices in criminal justice, with the moral certitude of life itself, with the true, the self-evident propositions of life that we know that have been passed down throughout Western tradition. And so when I was around 40 years old, which was a long time ago, I decided to go get a PhD, and I got a PhD in philosophy in addition to my law degrees. And it was there that I fell in love with St. Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle, both of them who I think are in the top five or six thinkers of all time. And I saw how relevant all the time these individuals were to the criminal justice model. Most people don't realize how much they wrote extensively about law and the nature of the system and due process. And, you know, when you really dig deep into the world of Aquinas and Aristotle, you frequently come up with a jurisprudence that is very dependable and reliable. And so when I fell in love with those two, I started to write about them. And my first book on this topic was in 2000. It was called Aquinas in the Courtroom. And that's where I looked at how lawyers and judges should act according to St. Thomas. And then it's just grown from that point. It's not stopping. I keep moving towards other facets of these thinkers. And as I've taught college students since 1977, this just shows you how ancient I am. I've taught college students this long. I've seen this steady and slow and precipitous decline in happiness in young people. And I said before I pass on into the next life, I'm going to write something that will give them a recipe for happiness, something that will remind them that it doesn't have to be as it is. There's another path you can follow. And that's what gave rise to this book called Finding Happiness in a Complex World, because it is a very complicated world. And yet the answers to finding happiness are really quite simple.
Well, interesting, and so you deal here with Aristotle and Aquinas. Tell our listeners more about, you know, who exactly are these individuals? I mean, you know, the names are perhaps are often bandied about, but bring us a little more in depth into these two individuals and why did they go together?
It is interesting the way Aristotle and Aquinas were picked together, and this was an extension of a previous work that I wrote on the natural law. I wrote a book on Aquinas, a couple books on Aquinas and the natural law. And then I said, you know, I'm always being criticized, which I was, because I was teaching in secular institutions. And they, of course, they have a caricature of St. Thomas, which is he's no more than a papist, a churchman, a zombie for the Vatican, so to speak. And they have no conception of how deep and how philosophical that he is. And I decided I would write a book on Cicero and Aquinas to show how they both reached the same conclusions. So Cicero, of course, is the great Roman thinker, the great Roman advocate, the great Roman lawyer, but he's also a pagan. And then, of course, we know St. Thomas, our 13th century patron saint of higher ed and the angelic doctor of the Roman Catholic Church. It's astounding how both of them reached the same conclusions. So this became a pattern for me. I said, well, let's see. I want to do the happiness side of this. And I said, who greater than to talk about happiness than a person born 300 years some before Christ entered the earth? And that was Aristotle, who wrote that magnificent work, Nicomachean Ethics, which is essentially a treatise on virtue and the happy life. And then, of course, as most people are aware, St. Thomas was in love with Aristotle. He called him, put it in quotes, the philosopher, anytime he referred to Aristotle. He never referred to him as Aristotle. He always called him the philosopher. And he wrote this giant, massive commentary on the Nicomachean Ethics. Thomas did, 1,600 years later, which examined the wisdom of the Nicomachean Ethics. And both of those texts, of course, led to my inclusion of these two persons because they both agreed. Here on the one hand, you have, again, another pagan, and on the other hand, the angelic doctor all coming together, crossing territory and meeting each other right in the middle of the field and agreeing on all the essential items for what it makes or what constitutes a happy and contented life. And that's why I picked them, because they were blood brothers in a way. They were certainly symbiotically tied, tethered together in their theological and their philosophical outlook on human existence. And that's why I think it's so important, because for those that maybe not be adherent Catholics, or they may not be good Christians or good Jews or whatever, if they are not, they still can go to someone who does not have a denomination who will give them the exact same recipe that St. Thomas does.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I guess it brings up an issue. You know, you're bringing these two people together. I mean, Aristotle from ancient Greece, I mean, someone that, you know, his lifespan was born in 384 B.C. and died in 322 B.C. And as we indicated earlier with Thomas Aquinas from the 13th century, I mean, someone born 1225 and died in 1274. But you seem to be indicating that there is indeed an objective reason, universal reason across the ages for all people and all times, and indeed that reason has to be part of faith.
Absolutely, and if you look inside of Finding Happiness, what I've done in every chapter and every section is you'll find me, first of all, let me just say this book was written for high school and college students, so it's a very accessible book. I'm not writing it for the academic crowd, okay? Some of them might read it, but not many might. So, but in any event, I put little snippets from Aristotle's works as well as St. Thomas's works. So side by side, you know, you'll see a little shaded block in Finding Happiness where Aristotle has a quote and then Thomas is right below him. He has a quote. And it's really astounding to see the similarities of approach and really the identicality of how they see the universe and the world. And it certainly, in both cases, culminates in the demand or insistence on a transcendent perspective. You cannot ever really be happy in the temporal world. You can never. You can be fleetingly happy. You can have certain contentment if you have your balance and you do things correctly, but you'll never attain the type of joy and the type of contentment that exists without recognizing the metaphysics of things. And I think that's what both of them do so well. You know, of course, Aristotle's God is more sterile. It's not God the Father, the imagery that we have as Catholics and Christians and Jews, but Aristotle understood that there was one prime mover, one first cause, one thing that started it all. There had to be a creator, and your aim is to perfect yourself to get as close to that creator as you can, just as Thomas said, that we're seeking out the beatific vision of God himself in order to be completely happy. So it really is amazing to me. I never tire of this comparison, because where I work and where I have worked so many years in academic life, there's such contempt for a religious perspective on life. There's this purge, Mosconian almost, Mosconian purge to get religion out of every aspect of human existence, and yet that's one of the most essential features for a happy human existence. So you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, I guess it brings up to mind, you know, of course, Pope Benedict XVI's Regensburg address back in 2006, where he emphasized the relationship between religion and reason, you know, the mind and the soul. Well, I guess, you know, thinking of happiness here, you know, what in order to be happy, why can't we just, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, as I guess it was the motto of the Stoics. You know, why do we have to have a belief in God to be happy? What does that bring?
Well, everything that exists in the temporal world can bring fleeting or temporary happiness if it's in moderation. It is not. It's not just having, it's having in the right quantities. But the distinction or difference is in how permanent that happiness is. How long does it last? Does it really fulfill the human condition? Does it provide human flourishing in the highest context? This is what the big debate about humanism always is, that I can be just as happy as anybody who has a spiritual life as long as I'm a good person. Well, you know, that may be true that you think you're as happy as you can be, but you're not even testing the waters. And one of the things that comes out in Finding Happiness is that the most extremely happy people have not only a virtuous and balanced life, you know, they also have a religious life. They have beliefs in things that are beyond them. I mean, you see it all over the place. How long do people live who have religion versus people that do not? How do you handle illness when you have no religion or you do have it? How long do marriages last when you have religion or don't? You can look through this entire text in Finding Happiness, and you keep coming back to this question that, yeah, you can have temporary bodily pleasure, But that's not going to fulfill you when you're 75 years old or 80 years old. And the passage of time and the corporeal body corrupts, and you know, the bodily pleasure becomes more of a distant memory, and more of your efforts are towards finding solace and joy inside the eventual afterlife. So yeah, from my vantage point, I wake up every day thinking to myself, I'm not a perfect person by any measure, but I would hate to wake up and think there's nothing beyond here. That's distressing and depressing in and of itself. Of course, modernists would often say we're delusional and we make these things up as matters of convenience, but I certainly don't think that's the case, because I, as St. Thomas believes, believing is part of the natural law. It's part of what makes us up as human beings. To believe is to be completely and totally natural and true to yourself. So it is an essential part of the happiness quotient. There's no question about it, because all the other chapters in Finding Happiness show how it falters, whether it's money, it's fame, it's power, it's honors, it's adulation. All that stuff evaporates over time.
Yeah, and I find it interesting in here, you write in the book that Aquinas, he was interested in Aristotle, which actually at his time was not something that was studied. Aristotle was actually not promoted. And he also was interested in Jewish and Islamic thinkers, like the Jewish philosopher Maimonides, and as well as the Muslim philosophers Avicenna or Ibn Rushd, as his Arabic name was, and Averroes. You know, so he had a really broad-minded thinking. And I guess it brings up the point that we sort of indicated here before, that here in this book and with these thinkers, that, you know, these are really, there really are universal principles of faith and indeed morality and happiness that, you know, are applicable to all people, irrespective of what particular religion they have. I mean, here we're starting with Aristotle, who's a pagan, so obviously, you know, far removed from anyone in the modern world. But then Aquinas as well, Catholic, you know, this speaks to everyone.
Oh, no, I think the book is very universal. I think that everything that is in this text are these propositions about human life that always pan out to be true. The last chapter of Finding Happiness is the summary of all the rules that both Aristotle and Aquinas pose in this text. Okay, so chapter by chapter, there's going to be a rule: do this and you'll be happy. I mean, really, it's that categorized and delineated. I do it on purpose because I want people to have a formula or a recipe or a checklist where they go in and say, if I live like this, will I be happier than not? I mean, and this is true when you go through the nature of family, marriage, sexuality, material possessions, all through this text, there's always the comparison between the people who have too much or have too little or don't have anything at all. And then there's a relationship between those conclusions and finding whether or not people are contented or not. I mean, people often say to me over my lifetime, I've been blessed to have seven wonderful children, and I've been married to my wife Jean Marie for 51 years. I don't know how she puts up with me, but she does. But she's been married to me all these years, and there's nothing more precious in my life than that type of contract, that type of promise, and having those offspring that make me proud every single day of the week. I cannot imagine life without them. And I often tell people when they tell me they're a burden or they cost too much or they did cost too much, I always say, you have no idea. You have no idea what joy has come into my heart because I live my life to the fullest. I flourished with them. I grew with them and watched them grow up to be adults. They're all adults now and they all make me extremely, extremely proud, every one of them. I could go on and talk about that for a half hour if you want, but I won't. I find that all of these rules really, every one of them work. And even if people can't follow every one of them, if they follow some of them or test a few of them, they might say, well, I'm going to test another one. I'm going to try another one. I'm going to try another one. And it's not going to make you, and this is another one of the great myths about what happiness is, that I'm happy, 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 as the song said, all the time. You're not. Happiness is not in a state of exhilaration, a kind of frenetic emotionalism. That is neither how Aristotle or Aquinas define what happiness, but it is a state of tranquility. It's a state of contentment. For all the things that have happened to me in my lifetime, and all the good and the bad, for all the periods of time when I have been down, because that's another thing that's natural to happiness, you can get down. You can be dejected. You can be sad. That's all normal. That's all part of the happiness quotient. I will say that I can leave this earth tomorrow and I feel fairly tranquil that I've done the best that I can do. Even though I'm not perfect, I feel that I've given it my best shot. And that's really what happiness is in the end. It's a state of reason, contentment. And I think that's what both of them bring to the table. They keep people in balance. They keep the equilibrium correct. Instead of being excessively happy or constantly depressed, you find the middle ground where you can survive literally anything.
Well, that's the point you bring out in the book, in order to be happy, you actually have to have limits, right? I mean, you have to avoid excess.
No, and that's true with literally everything from drinking to – now, of course, some behaviors are not subject to the excess defect rules. I often tell my students this. I explain them, you cannot be a moderate pedophile or you can't be a prostitute who's a very reasonable, moderate prostitute. That's impossible. Those behaviors aren't subject to the measure. But literally everything else is. I mean, sexuality is an example. Sexuality is often labeled for Catholics as being a miserable experience. But yet, why historically have families been so large? When you go to the Industrial Revolution, it isn't just a question of somebody being oppressed, which modernists like to say. It's a question that they were open to everything, and they naturally wanted children, and it all flows together. And so, but you have it in the context of a parameter known as marriage, not, one night stands and 35 boyfriends and girlfriends a year. And all these things are out of the mainstream. They're out of the excess defect quotient. So you have to look at human behavior in light of parameters. And I think the Roman Catholic Church does a very good job of putting sexuality in the context of being in a series of rules or parameters in which it is more enjoyed rather than if it's willy-nilly. I think John Paul II said that the people who cry for promiscuous sexual behavior are in bondage. They have no freedom or happiness at all. They have no joy because they're enslaved to the very things they think are making them happy. But in the end, they're not.
I find it interesting in the book that you talk about relationships and sexuality, and you say, true freedom in sexuality is where you can give yourself totally to another person, and you're committed to that person, and you're not worrying, how am I ultimately going to get out of this relationship or move on. That
right.
Really is that's not true freedom. That's really, as you're indicating, a kind of a bondage, and that entails also, as you indicate, being open to life. I'm talking about family life. I mean, you talk about you have seven kids. I mean, and you bring this up in the book. I mean, what is sort of the difference between? I mean, how important is family life? What happiness does that bring in? What are we seeing with, say, single people or people who don't have family?
Well, I think we're seeing the very negative effects culturally, collectively, as well as individually in our developing zero birth rate data that's coming out of the United States of America. How could anybody have ever believed that? We've always known that in France and Germany and continental Europe that the birth rate was plummeting, but now it's plummeting in the United States. It's being replaced by dogs. I used to see baby carriages going up and down the street in my neighborhood. Now all I see is people walking dogs with no children. There can be no, I don't, you know, maybe it's just my own bias, but I can't see how that is the flourishing of the marital state, because in order for a marital state to grow and for the individuals who are in the marital state to grow, they both need to make sacrifices, to be selfless to others. That's the whole essence of sexuality and marriage, and that is to develop and propagate the species. I mean, this is all part of our natural instincts. It's all part of the natural law. There aren't many things in the natural law. People often, of course, label the natural law as being this harsh series of edicts and promulgations, but it's really not true. It really only binds itself, aside from the one I already mentioned about a belief in the afterlife or a belief in a transcendent God, it also ties itself to human operations, how human beings live. And one of the things they naturally do is procreate. Another thing they do is they propagate the species. Another thing they do is when they do those two things, they have children and they love them and they naturally care for them. And another thing they do is that they teach them how to avoid ignorance and become educated and become wise and to learn the ways of life in many paths. There's no particular path. But all of those things, isn't it curious that every one of those things are part of the natural law delineation? And if you're not living naturally, because this is another thing that comes out from St. Thomas as well as Aristotle, you're not living virtuously. And if you're not living virtuously, you're living another way, and that way never leads to happiness. And in fact, that's one of the constant threads in finding happiness, that vice always leads to unhappiness. You can find, this is another one of the perennial questions I ask my students here, tell me a vice that makes you happy in some type of permanent sense. And they can't think of one because there isn't any. But if I ask them the same question about living in virtue, they have many. It's one of the reasons why the chapter on spiritual life in the text is so interesting, because it highlights people that give to others. Anybody who gets the text and looks at this, if you read anything in it, read the nun study. The nun study has been going on for literally decades. It's been an examination of nuns who entered an order, the SSNDs, the Sisters of Notre Dame, and reviewed and assesses their lifespans, how long they live, how healthy they are, how happy they are. None of these people have children, okay, but they give their lives to others. They're selfless. They teach. They care for others. They run hospitals. And so they're a very happy lot. And what happens out of that, it's even more fascinating, is they have a very low level of dementia and an extremely even lower level of Alzheimer's. And these Harvard and Johns Hopkins professors and other people are involved in this study, which is fully cited in Finding Happiness. They cannot understand it because these individuals have lesions on their brains, as people do who exhibit, and they have other qualities that look like you may have Alzheimer's, but they don't have it. And it's stunning to them. And they've concluded they don't have an explanation for it. Well, I do have an explanation for it. They're completely selfless. They give out, they live their lives for others, and they give their lives to God. They have their priorities all in the right place, and they live lives of virtue, and that's why they're happy.
Interesting. And well, talking about limits and others. How much money does a person need? I mean, you talk in the book about, questions of whether money makes people happy.
Oh, that's one of the biggest losers there is. I mean, look at the lottery winner studies that are cited in Finding Happiness. What happens to lottery winners? They, for the most part, are bankrupt within 3 years after they win their multi-millions. And, of course, they suffer the slings and arrows of everyone around them who wants their money, or they suffer victimization from so-called advisors who steal all their money, and or they suffer from a loss of friendships, relative affection. Whatever you're talking about, there's really very little joy in having multi-millions. I mean, there really is. I mean, all of the studies on lottery winners, which are cited in Finding Happiness, show a very depressed group of people very shortly. And the same is true for wealthy people. I do give many examples in very, very wealthy families, the billionaires, the very richest of people. And they are not the happiest lot either. The only group of very rich people that seem to be happy are the ones that are generous, charitable, are willing to share their wealth for good causes. They know that there has to be limitations because there's only so much you can do with money. I kind of cite the story of Andrew Carnegie here, who before he died, the last few years of his life, he was worth a ton of money. I think it was over $200 million. I can't remember the exact number. But he gave most of that away before he died. He left a legacy, Carnegie Libraries, music halls. And I think he gave it away because he indicated to people that this doesn't bring me any joy, but at least he left something behind. But today, we have all these people who make all this money, and they got nothing to show for it. Look at all the professional athletes that I feature in Finding Happiness. All the national football players, the National Hockey League, the National Basketball Association. More than 70% of them are bankrupt 3 years after they retire. There's so much money, they have so much money, and there's no joy, there's no happiness. And there's a lot of drinking problems, drug problems, suicide problems, so that won't bring you happiness either. Now, that doesn't mean that you want to be the other extreme and be destitute all the time. That doesn't bring much happiness either, but you want just enough and a little more possibly to live a life where there's not endless stress about where's the next dollar coming from. But on the other hand, if you are wealthy and you're lucky to become wealthy, it is imperative that you find good causes and good things to use that some of your funds for. And all the studies on charitable donors and charitable foundations, when you find people, one of the people I cite in the text is Gary Sinise, who's an actor who spends a lot of time working with veterans and is giving a great deal of his wealth to veterans from all the wars. He's a very happy man from most accounts, even though he's from Hollywood.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting point. It seems to be, as you're indicating, that really higher pleasure, true pleasure, requires a higher purpose, right? So it's actually, you do indeed receive when you give. It also sounds really fundamentally Christian message.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, it's not that we should do as St. Thomas says, should we give all our money away? He says that's not practical. He actually answers that question in the Summa. He actually answers another question on whether lawyers should do all their work for free. And he says, absolutely not. How do you expect to survive? How do you expect to have a law practice? And so, yeah, there is a balance between your own maintenance and your own joy at having sufficient funds to live a healthy and happy life, and the amassing and miserly attributes that people often have. You really wonder, too, when people get, they're worth $200 million or $300 million. How much money do you really want, And yet they're still craving it, still going after it. It's one of the reasons why greed is one of the seven capital sins. In fact, that's another one of the threads that comes through Finding Happiness, is that everything in here, if you want to find things that make you happy, stay away from the seven capital sins, because every one of them make you sad.
I guess in comparing religions, I don't know, do you have any indication or any evidence, or could anyone say that Christianity then is the happiest faith? That, given precisely these teachings from this angelic doctor of the church, Thomas Aquinas, is Christianity really the most joyful faith?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but if I had a bet on it, I would hold that it does, because Christianity is a balance of things. It doesn't tell you to avoid or hate the world. It tells you to live in the world, but live with love for your neighbor and for your own self, to take care of yourself. And I think the law of charity, which of course Christ espoused on his time on this earth, encapsulates all the other virtues. It tells you that you must be just, that you must be temperate, that you must, and when you read the Beatitudes or you read Jesus' sermons or any of his commentary, he's always stressing living a life of balance. You know, he doesn't go up to Mary Magdalene and say, it's okay, you can be a prostitute as long as you want. He says, you must leave that life. You can't live that life. There's a tendency of people today to think that Jesus never made judgments about human behavior. All you got to do is flip the pages in the New Testament, and you'll find Jesus constantly making judgments. And another great example, when I teach criminal law, when we get to the chapter on sentencing, and people often say that Jesus would never want someone dead for a crime. I often go to that provision in the Bible. I forget the specific quotation, when Jesus talks about protecting little children and how much he loves little children. And anyone who would harm a little child, he would tie a millstone around their neck and throw them into the ocean. You can't tell me that's not a judgment, because there are some behaviors that are so reprehensible that they're noted by Jesus, that the hurting of little children, which is becoming an extremely common event in our corrupted modern world, there's a toleration of it. There's less prison terms for people. There is even a move afoot to do away with the term pedophilia and replace it with a term called minor attracted persons. I don't know if you've heard of this, MAPS, and here's the reason for it. They don't want to make pedophiles feel like they're pedophiles, because it gives them a stigma. Well, that's a far cry from Jesus's condemnation of hurting the little children.
Yeah, interesting point about the millstone. I guess I never quite concretely thought about that passage from Jesus, that it does indeed indicate sort of a support for the death penalty. I mean, of course, you can talk too as well about, you know, he before Pontius Pilate, he mentioned that, you know, the authority for his order and execution comes from above and so forth. You bring up the issue of MAPS, these minor attracted persons, as they're now trying to be called, pedophiles. That really is grotesque. Well, you know, you talk here about, you mentioned, you know, you can't give everything away. I find it interesting in the book that you talk about how Aristotle and Aquinas, they foresaw that socialism would produce misery. I mean, talk about these two figures there. I mean, what sort of thoughts did they have on collectivism?
Oh, I have no doubt that Aristotle and Thomas are essentially the founders of private property ownership, or the reinforcers of that notion, because collectivism or ownership by only the royal class or whatever it is you're talking about at their time, the idea of private property ownership was not a given. But yet both of them saw private ownership as developing the type of incentive and human development related to economic life that was possible only when there could be some end game that was positive for you, and you're not your self-interest as much as your flourishing. Communism, as we know, which is the joint collective ownership of everything, destroys all human flourishing. There, I know no example in history where communism has succeeded. Of course, we live in a world in which the next pile of Marxists or the next group of socialists tells us we can improve this or it can be changed. But there's no evidence of that. What there is evidence of is that societies that are the most economically self-sufficient, the most flourishing, the most developing, are those in which human beings are freed to take part, to take ownership, to take control over the fruits of their labor. And both of them addressed that question, and both of them held that private ownership is far superior to any collective ownership. Why we see, and in fact, I remember as a child reading, I'm trying to remember precisely the Catholic newspaper I used to read. I think it was the National Catholic Register, but I'm not positive. But I always remember seeing at the top of the thing that communism and Catholicism are incompatible. And they really are, because the philosophy of the natural law and Catholic tradition cannot tolerate a collective ownership and collective control over anything. One thing you can be sure of is in a collectivist state, the value and integrity of a human being doesn't matter.
Yeah, I guess, of course, Catholics will often bring up in their teaching that, the Catholic Church has this preferential teaching for the poor. But I guess as you're indicating here, you would probably want, in Catholic social teaching, you'd probably want to emphasize, say, private charity and, issues of subsidiarity, that you try to, have more private actors and people closer to the source of an actual problem be engaged in any sort of alleviation of issues, rather than looking first and foremost to the state.
Well, and that is certainly part of the problem, too, is that when we see miles and miles of homeless people that are living on the street in Los Angeles and San Francisco, New York now, they're now cropping up in my present hometown of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. There's hundreds and hundreds of – how is it possible that you can live like this? Is it because you're getting private charity? No, it's governmental. And in fact, when they interview them and assess them, they're collecting all the benefits they can possibly get, from food stamps to welfare payments to, and in other words, we've created a new type of citizen who can live off of the state, who can, I don't mean this cruelly either. I'm not trying to be harsh. I'm trying to speak the reality of it. And that is that they feed off a system that makes it possible for them to function. If they had to survive and their other natural law instincts of self-preservation and so forth kicked in and they had to eat, they would not live the lives they're living. But they don't want to not live in tents. You try putting them in the Salvation Army. Try putting them in Catholic Charities. A lot of them don't want to go there because they can't get away with the things they're doing. So we have ruined human initiative in many respects by our overemphasis on helping allegedly the poor. But Jesus knew the poor. I understand what the poor is, the poor who have nothing. You can go to many countries in the world and encounter those poor. But when people are sitting on the street in California collecting, $1,100 or $800 a month in welfare, plus all other possible government benefits, that's not the poor that Jesus envisioned. He envisioned a poor that was really destitute, where we have a moral obligation to help. So it's a well-meaning purpose. I get it. This has a lot to do with my criminal justice background, hanging around it all these years. When you look at the homeless population, the majority are drug addicts. The majority have drug problems. They have addiction problems, and they're not interested in getting off of them. I don't know if there's an easy solution for that, but that's not something that Jesus ever encountered. It is time. But now we're encountering people by the hundreds of thousands in certain cities now. There's so much of it. So how do we pull them out? Is it constant giving that pulls them out, or is it something else? So you can do too much charity or too much giving away, and that's ruinous to the human person rather than helpful to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Well, and, going through these things that you go through all these things that, as you've indicated, that would often people think would make people happy. You've talked about entertainers. Does the approval of people really make people happy, or should rather a man really seek God's approval and not mankind's in order to be happy?
I always wonder why so many of these entertainers, like rock stars and you know, famous actors, they can never retire. They can never or do something else. You know, I'm not picking on them, but let's face it, people like Bruce Springsteen, who's in the text in Finding Happiness, he wrote a very eloquent and a very deep reflection on his own sadness. Now, and most people would say to themselves, why is Bruce Springsteen, why is he unhappy? You know, Bruce Springsteen, of course, you think he's worth $100 million? Maybe, if not a lot more than that. I don't have the slightest idea, but he's very, 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 very wealthy. And you would think that at this stage of his life, he would say to himself, should I go on the road and still do these shows so I can have adoring crowds looking at me all the time? Or should I construe myself as a person who's been a very lucky man, that I have all this wealth and maybe I should do something good with it? Like he helps that one Catholic school that he went to in New Jersey, in Asbury Park, New Jersey. Apparently he's a good donor for them. But given his largesse, the amount of money he has, he might get a little happier if he would give a lot more of it away to save and prop up wonderful little Catholic schools that make such a difference in our culture. And I really notice this about rich Catholics in general, too, is a lot of rich Catholics do not even save the very institutions that made Catholicism great. We do not have a lot of donors who have hefty paychecks and hefty money giving to these schools to keep them open. And to me, that's a recipe right there. That's a joyous action where you'll get involved with the salvation of institutions which save children, which help the poor, which help children who come from terrible families, which save and provide a school choice alternative to children that are trapped in horrible, horrible schools. And yet very few people do that. I often critique the Kennedys about that. Not picking on them, I'm just using them as an example. All that money and how much of it went to Catholic schools? Not much. So, you know, it is a problem. They just can't seem to, and then they wonder why they're sad later in life and they're not fulfilled. Paul McCartney's kind of like that too, you know. How much are you worth? Billions and billions. You still have to entertain. Or why don't you start music schools and help poor kids learn instruments? Do something. But they don't. I'm not saying they don't give money away. But, yeah, usually guys like Bill Gates and people like that, they always give money to Planned Parenthood, you know, or something that doesn't bring a lot of consistency with human flourishing. But in any event, you're absolutely right in that question. And they just can't seem to hang it up and find what will really make them happy.
That's interesting. Also, you then looking at, you know, another thing that, you know, people often crave and maybe they think will make them happy is, you know, power. But, you know, you seem to indicate in the book that power without purpose is pointless. So it's only, you know, only power that's used for good end will make someone happy, not just the, you know, just simply being a politician, career politician, just simply being in politics for the sake of being politics.
I probably will be accused of picking on them and finding happiness, but you know, one of my people I can't understand is Nancy Pelosi and her pictures in the book. So, you know, she's 82 years old and she can't give up on it. And she's not the only one. I mean, Patrick Leahy's 88 and Joe Biden is going to be 80 and, you know, Donald Trump's going to be 77. Can these people give it a break? I mean, they just can't. Mitch McConnell's old. And yet I think a lot of people see that. They're starting to say, well, you know, there's a time and a season and, you know, you just can't. Why do they have to hold on so keenly and intensely? And they fight for dear life to stay inside of the power base. They can't give it up. They can't say to themselves, well, I'm at another phase of my life. Maybe I should do something different, something that might bring me a little more joy than I have. Because I don't care what anybody says. They don't look all that happy to me. But I don't know. I'm not really – I can't internally judge what their happiness quotient is. But when you figure how the posture of Nancy Pelosi on so many things that are contrary to Catholicism, when she is allegedly a Catholic, I personally don't know how you can live like that. I don't. I don't know how you can be pro-abortion on the date of birth and claim you're a faithful Catholic. I don't get it. Any more than any of the other Catholic politicians are doing the exact same thing. I would venture to say they're not all that happy as people. And I would venture to say that people that are true to their faith and living their life compatibly with their faith and making decisions about these eternal and perennial truths about our faith are much happier people.
Well, you know, that brings up an interesting point. You're talking about, you know, rock stars, they don't want to give up their you know, they don't give up, or movie stars, they don't give up living in the limelight, you know, playing their music or being actors, or these politicians, you say, you know, Nancy Pelosi, you know, 82 and so on, they just keep on. And what is then the role? How would you evaluate, you know, some of those people just say, oh, I just love what I do, and I just want to keep on doing it, you know, until the day I die. Well, what do you think then is the role of retirement? Is that something that people really should have in order to be happy as well? Or can people just
say, no, I'll never retire? That's a great question, Andrew, because I'm one of those people that people might say that about. I retired out of John Jay in New York City, and then I said, will I really be happy when I'm completely retired? And according to people who know me, they all said, no, you won't. You won't. You like to be very active and like to do lots of things. But I also knew that I could no longer do the big giant city University of New York thing anymore. I was tired. I knew I couldn't handle the stresses and the pressures of that every day. So what do? I come from New York City to Steubenville, Ohio, to Franciscan University in a small, you know, 3,500 student school with lovely and joyous students. And I got an opportunity here to do something I've always wanted to do, and that was to create a criminal justice program rooted in Catholic tradition. And this is not retirement to me. This is not even a hobby. This is a mission. I feel like, as Father Dave says here, who's our president, we're rebuilding the church one brick at a time. And he's often referenced this criminal justice program here, which is brand new. It's 2 years old and it's booming, as being that place where we're going to create students and who will go into the world and make a difference in the criminal justice system. But it's not the retirement, okay, that I'm talking about. It's understanding your limitations. That's number one. But number two, having another purpose for existing. It can't be, I just want to go perform. I just want to be in power. I just want to keep making money. It's a dead-end street. You have to turn it into something else. You have to, you know, people often say that guy who sings for U2, his name is Bono, B-O-N-O. You know, maybe your audience knows him, maybe they don't. He's an Irish guy. You know, he's Irish Catholic. He has changed his life that way. I'm not saying he's a saint. I'm just trying to point out that he does a lot of work with the hunger in the world, and he's very involved in world poverty and all kinds of different very wonderful things, you know. And he's expended a lot of energy on that. And from all accounts, he seems to be very organized. He's less distressed than people like Amy Winehouse, who's discussed in this textbook. Amy Winehouse is a very sad story. She's an extremely talented singer, but she died essentially in a drunken stupor the last 6 days she was alive. I think she died at the age of 37 or 38, and she died, even though she had all this talent, looking at loops of herself playing over and over in her shows. And that little story, that little allegory, is where you see that you're not giving to others, you're not exercising a life of virtue. You are essentially exercising a life of vice. You're not only drinking and drugging yourself to death, you're so narcissistic, you can't think beyond your very existence. You can't look beyond it. And that's why they're so sad. That's why they're never, ever, ever going to be happy, because they have not pushed themselves out into the world to make a difference for other people. And that it isn't the retirement as much as the aim, the end game, the purpose, the shift, the view that I've been blessed, that I now do other things for other people for other reasons. And those reasons should always be based on the law of charity, the law of justice, doing the right thing for the right reasons. That's a big motto I have with my students here. We do the right thing not only because it's the right thing, but because it is the right thing.
Yeah, and I find it interesting here you make this point that, you know, in modern culture, the body has been elevated to levels that it, most of Western tradition would be almost inconceivable. But, you know, you talk about happiness cannot be rooted in corporal matter in a body, you know, because the body's corrupted, right? It's going to give way. We're all going to die. The body's going to fade away. We're going to age and so forth. And that true happiness has to be contemplative. I mean, if you're thinking true happiness is ultimately to come into union with God, well, God is spirit. So yeah, I guess you're really bringing out this point that happiness does indeed revolve around having a reflective life and not having an unreflected life.
Unquestionably, you know, and that of course is an Aristotelian conception that contemplation is the place to come up with the greatest form of happiness. And that contemplation, of course, you know, ends with the understanding as best we can about the God that the creator that made us. And then that's a pagan conception, but it's also a Christian conception. But in the modern world, we're so enslaved by the body, and the chapter on the body inside of Finding Happiness just unceasingly gives you examples from the obsession with plastic surgery to the equal obsession for staying young and never getting old, from the perspective that the young are more desirable than the older. They're certainly not wiser. I remember being young. That was stupid. So I'm a little smarter now than I was when I was really young. But that's okay. That's all part of the natural progression, and that's why we should be joyous about the elderly, the people that we meet that are older than us. This is all part of life's natural progression. It is certainly, as I'm 71 years old, I can give perfect testimony to how I have aches and pains I never envisioned before. I don't know where they all come from, except I know they're all part of the natural progression of human life. And people seek to find great joy in their bodies. They become obsessive exercisers. They think that if they run 37 marathons in a year, it's going to make them happy. They think that what their body looks like alone, it will make them happy. Or they think that you know, the people who work in the industry known as pornography are happy. Well, the complete opposite of that is true. Any study on porn people who star in pornography is a distressing tale by any measure. So the body is always a dead end street, because it collapses, it corrupts, it doesn't regenerate, and so. But it's all inevitably what God intends for us. We're only here for a little bit. We're not here for the later life, which goes on for eternity.
Yeah, well, I guess just one closing thought. I mean, you emphasize the importance of faith and the benefits it brings to individuals and society. It makes them healthier, happier, and they confront life's difficulties much better and so forth. How can society encourage faith, I guess, without being theocratic? I mean, you think of the United States here, you know, we've had this principle that we don't have an established church. So, you know, how do we encourage something that's so beneficial to society, but, you know, people then are always worried about, you know, theocracy?
Well, you know, we clearly do not have a theocracy, and it is clear that St. Thomas was opposed to a theocracy. He's explicit about it. You know, it's essentially leave to Caesar, Caesar, leave to God, God. And most theocracies in history have been total failures. I mean, they don't work well. They never have and never will. So, but in any event, I think what we're seeing a little bit of in terms of positive news, and we've studied this at the Center for Criminal Justice Law and Ethics, is the recent bevy of cases that have come from the Supreme Court of the United States in the last 7 or 8 years on religious expression. I think we've turned the corner on squelching, destroying, squashing, and annihilating religious expression. And we've seen this in recent cases. Now, we're always going to confront these cases, but we've never seen such pretty unanimous, not unanimous, but unanimity in the view that religious expression is an extremely important right, and that it trumps literally everything else. That's part of our founding philosophy. I mean, that there's a reason why the early founding fathers put religious expression in Amendment Number 1. That wasn't done just haphazardly. That was done intentionally because they didn't want religion crushed like it was being in England if you weren't part of the Church of England. But they did want religious expression to reign freely and supremely. So what you see now is you see Supreme Court decisions, two of them on the Little Sisters of the Poor, saying you cannot force the Little Sisters of the Poor to give abortifacients and birth control pills to their employees. Same event happened with Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby does not have to provide that. The same thing has come out with a Masterpiece Cake Shop case. You don't have to force bakers that are evangelicals to provide cakes to same-sex marriage people. And why is it in all those cases that that's happening? It's because the court recognizes that the power of a religious expression trumps any other right. And it really does. And if we return to that understanding and that recognition, if we, and the same was true with the case from the Catholic Archdiocese of Philadelphia on the adoption question and whether or not they had to be forced to allow adoptions for gay couples. The diocese drew the line and said, we cannot. It's inconsistent with our teachings. Given all that, there at least is a recognition that religious expression is important to the populace. It's important for a lot of reasons, especially the flourishing of any given society. Religious peoples, religious individuals, they last longer, they live longer, they stay married longer, they have fewer social problems, they have you know, it's been one of the great stories in the black community when religion essentially keeps even the hardest situations afloat, because that faith is what binds people together in some of the poorer communities in the United States. It's not true for every community, but it is true for some. I think finding happiness proves that without any religion at all, you're destined to descend into something much worse than if you had it.
Well, then, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, a weekly Blog Talk radio show where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And we've been listening to Franciscan University Professor of Criminal Justice, Charles Nemeth, and he's published a new book with Sophia Institute Press, Finding Happiness in a Complex World, Rules from Aristotle and Aquinas. Well, Charles Nemeth, thank you for joining the show.
It's been my honor, and I thank you for all your piercing questions.
All right, then. If our listeners out there, join us next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.